I'm Celine McKay, and you're listening to the Pure Green Podcast, episode 25. This week, I'm bringing you an episode that is packed to the gills with incredible information. If you've ever been interested in learning more about harvesting wild, native plants, either to eat or to make simple remedies and salves, you're going to love this episode. I had the opportunity to sit down with Laura Gilmore, a teacher, wildcrafter, and herbologist whose knowledge about ecology, plants, and their uses is incredibly vast. She's so passionate about her work, you can really tell, and I was captivated during our entire conversation.
We're not going back, but we're able to take an essence of something from which is from our past and combine it with what we know now, make something that is like uniquely modern moving forward.
Put simply, wildcrafting is the act of going out into the natural world, be it your backyard or nearby forests or fields, and harvesting wild plants for medicine or eating. While this is something that our ancestors would have done out of necessity, as of late, the craft has been enjoying somewhat of a revival. I myself am incredibly intrigued, but I realize that there's a ton to know, which is why talking with Laura was so incredible. She provided a lot of tips and advice on how to get started safely. We also talk about the place that wildcrafting has in a modern world and what Laura envisions for its future. We talk about bitters and why that taste is something we've grown unaccustomed to and why it's actually crucial for proper digestion. And she shares great ideas for crafting your own wild bitters. We talk about Laura's five rights, which are her guidelines for safe harvesting, information that's incredibly valuable just on its own. And finally, Laura shares what she's harvesting right now and how you can too. There's a lot more packed in there. This is an episode you'll want to listen to once just to enjoy and another to take notes if you've ever been interested in learning more about harvesting the incredible bounty that Mother Nature has placed right outside your back door. Here's Laura. So Laura, thank you so much for joining me today. I'm really excited to be talking to you about wildcrafting.
Thanks so much. Thanks for having me.
So why don't we start off with a little bit of a background on what wildcrafting actually is.
So wildcrafting really is just the act of going out into your backyard or the forest or fields and bringing back wild plants to use for food or medicine.
And you've taken wildcrafting beyond just a hobby and turned it into a business.
Yeah, so for a good 12 years, I would consider that working with wild plants was more of a hobby. But I'd actually say more pretty much my whole life I've been doing working with plants for fun. But in the last year, I decided I really wanted to take what I've been doing for myself and for my friends and for my family and start being able to bring it to my community and people all across my region.
And it's been going well, I gather.
Yeah. So just in the last few months, the products have been really well received by people. Stores are starting to take a lot of interest, and it looks like this fall I'll be starting to do some bigger events. So it's really exciting to be spending so much time this spring making huge quantities of wild harvested plant foods for such a large number of people. I'm so excited to get to share it.
Yeah, well, I've had the pleasure of trying maybe five or six of your different products, and they're fantastic. My favorite right now, because it's been so useful, is your elderberry syrup, which I've been giving to Charlie quite a lot because she just seems to be sick all the time, and it's been fantastic, really a godsend. And your products in general are just so interesting to me because they're flavors that I didn't even realize came from around me. I mean, it was just such a discovery to me, and learning how to cook with them and all of these different things. So I'm curious what kind of learning curve you had in learning how to cook and actually use the products that you're making, and sort of could you walk us through what some of your most popular products are?
Yeah, for sure. I was really fortunate when I was young. This old traditional Italian woman used to take care of me when I was like 5-6 years old. And I think she was probably the main reason I'm into this, because we would go out into those fields and I would run around like a young child, but she would be picking greens and mushrooms. And then we'd go back into her traditional kitchen and I would just watch her put them into things. And And then I grew up the rest of my life just kind of thinking that it was totally normal to eat wild things. And it wasn't until I became an adult that I actually started to realize that it wasn't a common thing. And then kind of I went away to college and I started getting more into environmental studies and food, just starting to be an adult, trying to feed myself in a good way. And that's when I kind of really started playing for myself. And starting off, I think I tried to take wild foods more as like the base, and I've realized that it's really hard to supplement wild foods to think that you're going to supply like your main grains or your main amount of your protein, unless you're talking about meat. But I've really learned over the years that the easiest way to incorporate wild foods into my daily life is to think of them like spices. They're these incredibly rich, potent, you know, gems of flavor that we can incorporate into really our modern diet through infusions of vinegar, through infusions of oil, through drying them and using them as like flavor enhancers, like we use all of our other spices, because so many of the spices in our regular spice cabinet are medicinal, you know, plants when we use them in other ways. And so many of our wild plants really are quite medicinal too. So I find that's actually the best way to start using wild foods, is just incorporating them like spices. Instead of thinking that we're going to easily go out and like make all of our salad or harvest all of our grains or harvest all of our vegetables from wild, from the forests.
Yeah, I love that you talk about it as gems of flavor. That's really, it gives you a really great visual, or sort of imagine how flavorful these are. And that's one thing about wild foods that that I know you've talked about before, that when you're first getting into it, you have to take it a little slow because you're just not used to it. So what are some of the ways, or what are some of the things about wild food that's different and that we may have to get used to and sort of be careful about?
Yeah, so cultivated plants really are all originated from wild plants. But as we've gone for, you know, agriculture is about 10,000 years old. And when we started to kind of cultivate wild plants, what we did is we selected plants that had a little bit you know, bigger seeds or were not as bitter. And so now basically 10,000 years later, our cultivated plants are not as nutrient dense, or as an herbalist, I kind of call them like constituents. Those are like the real complex plant chemistry. Tastes like bitter, tastes things that are pungent. Those kind of constituents we've really bred out of cultivated plants, and so we're used to eating large portions of food. So the biggest thing for me when I'm teaching people about wild foods is, for example, with a salad, if I'm going to go out and pick a wild salad, my serving portion size of a wild salad is really going to be something that I can fit pretty much in my hand, as opposed to kind of the large dinner plate size salad that I would get if I, say, went out to a restaurant and was served, you know, greenhouse tomatoes and iceberg lettuce. That the amount of nutrients and just, like, I think of just, like, intense plant chemistry and wild plants is just so much more compact, so that your portion size you really want to keep small when you're starting out. Because especially if you're not used to wild foods, there's a lot of chemistry there being introduced to your body, and you just want to make sure you take it slow.
There's a book that I read that is honestly one of my favorite books about food. It's by Joe Robinson, and it talks about the path, or the evolution of our food from the wild, you know, the root of it in the wild through to what we have now. And it's really shocking sometimes in the way that we've bred things for sweetness as opposed to nutrition primarily. That seems to be it was a common thread in the book. And it's honestly part of what got me interested in harvesting wild foods, because when she talked about the difference in nutrition and in taste and in potency between those foods and what we have now, it just seems like filler. It's like something to get full on compared to what it was before. I mean, it's really really interesting to me. And I'll put that book in the show notes so that listeners can look it up, because it really is such a worthwhile read.
Yeah, there's also a huge amount of we basically on average now eat a very small percentage of plants compared to what we used to. So if you were to actually be a hunter-gatherer, you would probably know in your region that you lived in, you would likely over the course of a year be consuming over 200 different types of plants.
Wow.
So because every season even every few weeks you're eating a small set of different plants, because that's one thing as a wildcrafter, you learn that the season for harvesting things is actually quite short. For each individual plant, it's actually only probably certain parts of it are only good for maybe a week, a few days. But if you were to actually be consuming plants year-round, living on the land, you would actually, in this region, probably be eating over 200 different plants.
Oh my gosh, that is so interesting. And you mentioned something that you said made me think about how our ancestors, I don't know how many hundreds of years ago, I mean, maybe you could speak to that a bit more accurately than I, but it used to be something that we did for survival. You would, not for survival necessarily, for subsistence, like there was still farming and cultivation. I mean, that goes back thousands and thousands of years, but still for medicinal purposes in particular, wildcrafting and knowing about herbology and how it interacts with the body and what to use for what was commonplace. And so now we've come with the introduction of pharmacies and with synthetic drugs, we have come so far from that that it seems almost foreign to even think about it in that way. So I'm curious what you would say is the place of wildcrafting sort of in our modern society, and do you see a shift in interest heading back that way, or sort of what is your prediction? I know that's a big question, but on the direction of wildcrafting.
Yeah, so from a food perspective, I just actually really believe that the more we understand about our natural environment, so from like just even a mental health and connection to place perspective, incorporating small amounts of wildcrafting are a way just to actually be more connected to the land. So from a cultural perspective, I think it's really important. From a culinary perspective, I'd love to see regions throughout the world really develop what is the true local flavor of where you are. So from a, just way of like building culture in connection to place, I think there absolutely is room, a really neat way to reintroduce wildcrafting in a modern context, because no, we're not going to go back out to living as hunter-gatherers.
Mm-hmm.
And for the most part, people are still going to want to incorporate. And we have a really, in North America, we've really been able to incorporate foods from all over the world and create amazing dishes. I think of the way that I work with wild plants and combine it with something like ginger. We're not going back, but we're able to take an essence of something from, which is from our past, and combine it with what we know now, make something that is like uniquely modern moving forward. So from a food perspective, I just think it's a way that we can create just like an interesting new movement that is more, more green, that connects us to place, that also just introduces new flavors and something totally unique and different, that is of the place wherever you are. From a medicinal perspective, I really feel that common knowledge that you spoke to a few hundred years ago, of basically everybody knew really common remedies because doctors weren't available. They were very few and far between. Every family had to know how to treat colds and flus and ear infections and, not complex things. And I'm extremely happy we have doctors and emergency rooms that I can go to if I break my leg or I get hit by a car. But I also think we have huge issues. I mean, in Canada where we are, where we have a healthcare system that is, it's overtaxed. We have long lineups if you go to the emergency room. And if we were able to take back a little bit of that common knowledge, and if people felt more confident being able to use, whether it's some wild harvested plants or just the herbs that are in their kitchen to treat common things, I think of particularly young parents that I work with would maybe feel a little bit more confident in being able to treat the basic things at home. And if there were more, you know, community herbalists that could kind of support, you know, those families in their own really small local community, we actually could have a modern role in being able to take some pressure off the healthcare system so that doctors in those emergency rooms, as opposed to being taxed by ear infections and bad cases of the flu, that healthcare system could focus on, you know, real traumatic injuries and severe infections. And it's not that it's a replacement, but I think a little bit more if people were able to take back a bit of that responsibility for maintaining their health, and being able to treat like super common things, there's totally a place, because we talk constantly in Canada, at least, about long waits and are needing our healthcare dollars to go further. So I think just this sense of being able for people to feel that they've got some tools and to work with that are effective and that gives them a sense that they have an ability to care for themselves, at least in really basic conditions.
Mm-hmm. Wow, I could go so many directions based on that answer. Like, wow, so much knowledge, Laura. You impressed me so much. But I just want to touch briefly because I loved what you said about a connection to place and a true local flavor. I mean, wow, because, you know, we're doing a lot about in-season eating right now with Pure Green. We have a whole project dedicated towards it, but really it's about food that is locally grown and cultivated, I guess. It doesn't really, when you start thinking about true local food, I mean, what you're doing, I mean, that takes it to a whole next level. And, you know, getting that true sense of place and connection to your environment, I mean, that is super, super inspiring to me. And I loved as well, like, as you were talking, what came to mind for me was that the more education that we have about these two kinds of things, the more people get out there and learn about how to identify and use these plants, I feel like the more invested we'll be in conservation too. You know, you become passionate about something that you're connected to and that you use in a way that, I mean, not that spending time outside isn't meaningful, but in a way that is super, you know, you're super engaged with. You just want to see it survive and thrive. And so I think that's an exciting benefit too. Mm-hmm. But what you were talking about, you know, when you left off there about ways that we can treat ourselves, I mean, ironically, one of the things that's popping up in my head is I'm thinking that I'm almost a little nervous doing it because, I mean, how odd is that? I mean, these are plants that grow all around us, but, you know, I'm thinking I'm a little scared to, like, do that with my daughter for fear of messing it up, or, like, there's lots of different things, but I think that increasing that knowledge and then increasing the comfort level is so important. But it's ironic to me that there's a bit of that unease around it, which I want to get into a little bit later for sure. But I was curious, what are some of the ways that you treat yourself, like some of the common things that you would, you know, not get from the drugstore that you're getting from the forest or the field or whatever?
Yeah, so, I mean, I'm trying to think of what kind of, really, where I'm really starting actually is in preventative health. That's one of the biggest things that I work with. So throughout the winter, that's often the season, particularly here in you know, Canada, where we've got really cold winters that people are really susceptible to stuff. So years ago, one of the first things that I started working with, it was one of the first things is elderberry syrup. And it actually is one of the most popular remedies that I sell. And so I started making elderberry syrup and taking it to prevent getting colds and flus. Really, one of the first things I started treating, I had chronic pneumonia and bronchitis as a child from exposure to mold in a house.
Mm.
And for years, my lungs were really scarred, and I would get sick every winter in these really severe cases of bronchitis. So I was around 20, and I was starting to get into herbal medicine, and so starting to learn how to make these lung steams to prevent the colds from settling in my lungs and causing the bronchitis was actually one of the very first remedies I started using. And fortunately, after a few years of really being able to treat my lungs carefully and preventing those deep infections, I haven't had bronchitis in a very, very long time. So that was probably one of the first things. But cold and flu treatments, you know, which are super basic things, That's something I treat myself for. You know, cuts and scrapes and stings and poison ivy, all of those really like kind of basic, as long, especially if you're someone who spends a lot of time outdoors, those are going to be things you're coming across all the time. So I don't use polysporin, or, you know, I've never had to get cortisol cream for poison ivy. There's so many things that, because I know the remedies and I can find them quickly, they don't progress to those awful states that often, sometimes people will come to me with like poison ivy all the way up their leg because it's been spreading for 3 weeks. Mm-hmm. Whereas I find, like, now that I know the remedies, I can really nip things in the butt right away. And that's a big, big thing with herbal remedies and with working with plants. They often work better if you get to them early, as opposed to letting them really sink in deep. That's when they get hard to treat. But really, it's first aid, colds and flus, and then as I got to be more comfortable with working with herbs and my understanding of, even just through becoming an herbalist, like I started to understand anatomy and physiology. I treat my own uterine tract infections now without antibiotics, which is for women, UTI infections are pretty common. But that's a little thing, like I think it takes a little bit of experience to say treat something like that. But I've yet to try to heal a broken bone or anything like that on myself.
Yeah. No, I mean, that's something you might not want to... Yeah, I mean, I get it that there's limitations to this kind of thing, and there's still a place for modern medicine for sure.
Yeah, but herbal medicine can also be a really great complementary therapy to supporting people while they're still using, you know, you still get the doctor's set and cast your leg, and maybe you're taking the painkillers, but there's other things that, you know, in the broken leg, for example, there's, you know, herbs that are super high in minerals and constituents that'll facilitate helping that healing. And
Yeah. I mean, I'm reminded of my husband Jonathan. When he was younger, he broke his leg in 6 places, and you know, they were telling his mother things like, he'll probably never walk normally again, it's going to take forever to heal. And I can't speak to the details, but I know that, you know, she really believed in a lot of these alternative medicines and different ways of treating things as well. So of course they still had to go and get it medically treated. It was a very serious injury, but not only did he recover fully, he did so in half the time. So I mean, definitely there's so much that you can do to take it, you know, that next step, the step further.
That story is not uncommon.
No,
and they sound like, oh, the miracle story?
Yeah.
But it's actually super consistent.
Yeah, which is incredible. Mm-hmm. And again, I mean, you're dropping so many nuggets of wisdom, and I'm a little torn on which direction I want to go next. But I know that you've talked to me before about bitter, and we talked about it super briefly already, but I was... One of the things that you said that really stuck with me is the role that bitter has in our digestion. Mm. And that's something that, you know, you hear a lot about bitters, and it's a bit popular right now. You know, we've even done a feature on a bitters company, Dram Apothecary, and I absolutely adore them. But I think that there's a little bit of misunderstanding or just lack of understanding about what bitters, what role they can play, and particularly with our digestions. I wondered if you could speak to that a little bit, because I find it so fascinating.
Yeah, sure. So again, going back to traditional hunter-gatherer culture, and even traditional diets, true traditional diets around the world, there is always an element of bitter. So there are a lot of wild plants that contain those elements of bitter, and in particular in our Western diet, that is the one taste. So in traditional Chinese medicine, we have these things basically at the base around the 5 flavors: sweet and pungent, bitter, salty, and sour. And in our Western diet, we really love pungent. So those are things like onions and garlics. We love sweet. We like salty, we're not too aversion to sour, we have lemons, but we have completely eliminated bitter from our diet. And bitter is a really important constituent, especially as it relates, as you said, to digestion. And especially we really see that in our Western diet, a lot of people are suffering from digestion issues. And it's manifesting in a number of different ways, but a lot of them are related, obviously, to rooted in poor digestion. So knowing that traditional diets and in wild foods, there's a lot of bitter, as humans, we've evolved to being able to consume bitter. It's been a very short period of time that we've eliminated bitter from our diets. So our body has receptors for those bitter constituents all the way, starting in our mouth, all the way through our digestive tract, in our liver, in our gallbladder. And what bitter does is the receptors for bitter, when they're initiated by those bitter constituents in the plants, it tells the digestive system to basically, it says, get ready. It challenges the digestive system to basically be prepared for a big meal coming. And the entire digestive system actually starts to work. So it's basically put on ready and it begins to function at its highest capacity. First thing I'll notice when I take some bitters into my mouth and like, you know, bitter extract or a bitter herb, you know, if I chew some dandelion leaves, when I swallow it and I tune into my body, the first sensation that I feel is my mouth actually starts to salivate. And that salivation process, you know, those enzymes that are created in my mouth, is that first step in digestion. So what I'm feeling in my mouth by those, you know, those bitter receptors being initiated, that action begins to continue down all the way through your body. And so, yeah, by consuming small amounts of bitters at the beginning of meals, basically allows you to better digest that entire meal. So I was sharing that last time we talked that I now make a little aperitif of some bitters and a little bit of soda water and a dash of cranberry juice that my family and I now do our kind of Thanksgiving dinner toast with. And then we do this little toast and we toast to our health and we drink this little dash of bitters, and they don't often even really taste the bitters that much, you know, because you can make really nice bitters these days that taste quite good.
Yeah.
But then everyone afterwards is like, oh, I don't feel so bad. What you'll find is like you're not feeling like you need to undo that top button of your pants. And
yeah, there's no food coma.
Yeah, no food. The food coma is definitely reduced.
Yeah.
So that's one super modern way of being able to bring back some of that wild flavor, but
yeah. Wow. That, I mean, is something so simple, and yet I had no idea, really. And it's funny that you were talking as well, like our evolutionary body. I guess from a survival point of view, we were adapted to like sweet because that usually indicated safe, whereas bitter often indicated unsafe. Is that sort of...
A little bit.
Yeah.
Yeah, sweet, though, because there's so few there's so few things that are sweet. So sweet was also the indicator of high calorie.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's interesting, our modern diet now, we're so evolutionarily driven to want sweet to pack on calories, because sweet in nature is actually not that common.
No, like I can think of like berries and maybe some edible flowers.
But they're very seasonally abundant.
Exactly.
And when you found them, there was a natural reaction to want to consume a lot of them because it was so short of, and they were so high calorie,
mm-hmm,
that there is a natural part of our body that is driven to consume a lot. That's why we naturally develop that addiction to it.
Mm-hmm.
Bitter, yes. Sometimes bitter does tell you to consume small amounts.
Okay.
And really strong bitter, it can be an indicator to not consume that plant. But really, yes, the bitter is the high potency, even on the, you know, when I work in traditional Chinese medicine, bitter is always my reminder when I taste in the herb, this is going to be something that I use more as a medicine than I use as a food.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're taking them in small amounts.
Mm-hmm.
So yes, there is there's that, it is being received by the body and triggered, but there's, you know, the part of your brain that also receives bitter is also gonna come on to alert and just say, okay, this is something that I need to proceed with caution. And it is important. Like, I don't recommend bitters for, you know, breastfeeding or nursing women, because they are just very strongly medicinal. And a lot of the bitters are detoxifying. So they because of their reaction in the liver and the gallbladder, they get toxins moving in the body. And so there a lot of detox, you know, kits and cleanses that people will do are actually really focused on bitter herbs, because their role is to detoxify the body, get things moving into the blood, get things, you know, toxins to help to facilitate them to move out of our body. So taking small amounts of bitters on a regular basis actually does facilitate gentle cleansing over time, as opposed to, you know, I'm going to do a 3-week intense cleanse. And
yeah.
But that gentle detoxification we don't recommend for pregnant nursing women, just because you don't want to take maybe toxins that are embedded in your liver and get them into your bloodstream.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Oh, that's interesting.
So, yes, yeah, so bitter is a constituent that you want to pay attention to, because they're not the food plants. They're not stuff that you're taking in large quantities. That's why sweet and those herbs that are considered sweet and those herbs that are considered pungent, you know, those flavors that we're a bit more used to, they're definitely more of the food-based plants.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Wow. And so if someone wanted to, I wasn't really going to go here, but since we're talking about bitters, it kind of seems to make sense, is that one of the common bitters that people can have access to is dandelion. So that's probably, it's super safe, and there's so much of it, except for the stem, that you can eat, and so that's a really safe one. So outside of buying sort of handcrafted small batch bitters, it's a really simple way that people could incorporate a little bit into their diet. So if you were to choose kind of one part of the dandelion, that's easy for listeners to try.
Yeah.
What would you tell them about dandelion and how to incorporate it for the bitter benefit?
Yeah. Oh my God, so hard because they're so good. I mean, yeah. The spring greens are really easy, but probably the one that's most consistent is the root.
Mm-hmm.
So if you have somewhere that you can dig the roots pretty easily, in a clean environment, I'll tell you. So whether it's, you know, maybe someone you know has an organic garden, they probably have more dandelions than they need. So somewhere that you can dig the root from good soil. I like to dig the roots in the spring and the fall. And I'll wash them and chop them up, and you can infuse them. If you wanted to make your own bitters, you could infuse them. So you fill a jar just loosely to about an inch from the top. And so for like a cocktails bitters or pre-dinner digestive bitters, you could fill that jar up with vodka, or you could fill that jar up if you don't want alcohol. You could fill that jar with apple cider vinegar. So either one, put the lid on. Let it sit for 2 weeks, shaking it once a day, and then you strain out the liquid, and that liquid, especially if you've used vodka, something clear, you'll see it'll take on the color of the root.
Mm-hmm.
And then now if you have the vodka, then you could put in a little bottle, and you would use 20 drops, you know, as a little cocktail bitter, or that infused vinegar, then you can use on salad dressings, or in marinades or different things, just to get a little, you know, take a little sip of it. And that's, those are nice ways to, that are easy, and those will, you know, they last for a year, they're easy to use, they're in a cupboard, you know, in your spice cupboard.
Yeah, and super safe.
Super safe, yeah. But yeah. Definitely on the scale of bitter, dandelion is one of the ones we are like the low end of bitter.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, and then there's intense herbs like gentian or wormwood, which are very medicinal plants. Wormwood is what we make absinthe out of.
Oh, wow.
Anyone's had absinthe there. It's a very intense plant. But those are, so dandelion is definitely on the very safe end of the bitters, and something we consider more like food.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So that does sound easy, which is great, and it segues really nicely into how to harvest wild plants. Like, you have a series of guidelines, you call them the five rights, that sort of provide a framework around harvesting wild plants. So I wondered if you could go through those kind of quickly, just so that listeners know what are some of the things to look out for.
Sure. So my five rights. So I begin with the right place. So right place can be kind of broken down into two different things. So right place from a legal perspective. So I'm, as a wildcrafter and also as an ecologist, I am concerned about a little bit about the new trends in wild foraging. People definitely are getting pretty excited, and some places are being harvested in where they shouldn't be. So you want to make sure you're, so in Canada anyway, in Ontario, we have Crown land, which is essentially owned by the Queen, but it's land that we all have access to, and primarily logging happens on Crown land, but all people are allowed to harvest non-timber products. So we can wildcraft on Crown land. In the United States, state forests
mm-hmm.
are also the same. So you can harvest greens, you know, and plants, berries from state forests. You can harvest, obviously, from private land that you're given permission. I really prefer to harvest on private land where I know I'm the only person harvesting. I can really keep track of populations that way. You also can really know who's going to be in those areas and get to know the history of the land. So just making sure you're not harvesting from, you know, national or provincial parks and conservation areas, things like that. That has to do with right place. I also talk about in relation to your own safety. So you want to make sure, so medicinal plants are medicinal because they absorb the nutrients from the soil. So if the soil is contaminated, then you're going to have plants that are contaminated.
Mm-hmm.
So I avoid harvesting from any properties that, you know, were potentially used for mining or, you know, old landfill sites. You got to watch. Sometimes parks are built on old landfill sites that have been converted. I avoid hydro corridors or railway lines. Sometimes hydro corridors are managed just through cutting. Sometimes they're managed through spraying. So you really have to know. Railway corridors are awful. They'll peeling because you'll see lots of berries growing, or, you know, lots of really good plants growing along the edges, but they're pretty contaminated sites from the creosote and the logs and some of the spraying that they do along the edges. So you just want to take a moment and think about what's the history of the land and is this soil clean? So if the soil isn't clean, the plants aren't going to be necessarily safe
mm-hmm.
to consume. Yeah, so the plants really are going to be a reflection of what's happening underneath the ground.
Right, and that's not something that you would know, really, just by looking at it.
Not just by looking at it. Sometimes it takes a little bit of poking around.
Mm-hmm.
And people that get into wildcrafting, you kind of have, you find your foraging spot.
Yeah.
They become your foraging, because it takes a bit of work to find them.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
And that's, you know, I often get requests, people asking me where they can go to get certain things, and you know, people, it's like the joke about, you know, no one tells you their leak spot or their mushroom spot, but the truth is, because it takes time to find those things.
Yeah, absolutely.
So sometimes it takes a bit, and it's actually, I actually really love that act of having to research the land that I'm
mm-hmm.
on, because it's just, again, in developing that connection to place, it's like this understanding of the heritage and the history, and, you know, makes you appreciate it that much more once you really get a good foraging spot, because then you're able to develop a relationship with that place over time, and you know a bit about its history, and you become a part of its future.
I love that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's really nice. Okay, so right place, and what's the second one?
Yeah, so right plant. Probably most, you know, like the most obvious one.
But
requires, requires some description. So I definitely... this is the part that I think people are frustrated a bit with when they first start wildcrafting, is that it takes time building relationships with plants, because plants are the way that they look is extremely variable.
Mm-hmm.
They don't look the same all the time. So from the, you know, a plant can look completely different 1 month to the next, you know, as it evolves through its growing season. So it's not, this is where one plant book is basically, you know, a plant book that you get, or a picture that you see is really a snapshot of that plant in that moment, in that place. And it's not always reflective of how it's going to look all the time. So I recommend people to take it slow, and this is the frustrating part for people. So, I mean, when I'm working with my long-term students, I'll get them to follow a plant through its entire growing season before ever working with it. But really what I tell people is you want to, when you're identifying plants, your best is having a mentor, someone that knows the plants really well, that can introduce them to you. I always think of it the way I trust, like, people. If a friend of mine introduces me to someone, I'm going to, like, trust them a lot sooner, mm-hmm. as opposed to just, like, meeting a stranger on the street and, like, having to build more of a relationship before I can trust them. It's the same. So if I have a good friend who knows this plant really well, they've been working with it for years, they introduce it to me, I'm going to feel pretty confident with it probably from the beginning. But if it's a plant that I'm going out and I've never seen it before, I'm going to probably use, so what I recommend to people is to use at least 3 different resources for identification. And a person, like a, you know, someone you're working, you know, you could say a plant expert or someone that has worked with that plant, you could say that's one resource.
Mm-hmm.
And so you want to use good, you know, if you're working with books, you want to use field guides that are more focused on the botany and less about their uses.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so there's often, you know, field guides that are really focused just on how to use the plant, but they're often pretty limited on how to describe them. So I often have a lot of books that are just like, you know, Newcomb's Wildflower Guide or like Plants of Central Ontario. They actually don't have much of the information about how to use them. They're really focused on helping you to see the how the exact plant is arranged and what it looks like. And I really like books that have a combination of line drawings and photographs.
Hmm.
So the line drawings, you know, little illustrations,
yeah. Yeah.
often point out key features that are really important, where sometimes you might miss it if you just look at the photographs.
Right. Yeah, they yeah. always have, like, they point to certain things and highlight yep. them. And
yeah, so hmm. those are the kind of resources I get people, you know, when I'm saying when you're looking for a plant book, you know, get ones that are local to your area. You know, a book from that covers all of North America, you might think you've got the right plant, but maybe that plant only grows in Arizona. So if you can find in every, almost anywhere I've ever been, there's somewhere that, you know, if it's going to be Plants of Ontario or Plants of Michigan or like Plants of Southern California,
mm-hmm.
you can find resources just for your kind of particular area. And those I recommend to people because it really narrows the amount down so that you're more likely going to be able to get the right identification. But that's definitely the part that takes the right time. But you definitely, and the other thing, I always play my own devil's advocate. So I always make sure I'm giving myself, again, I like the threes when it comes to this. So I use 3 resources and then I give myself 3 really good reasons why it's that plant. You know, I should have at least 3 physical characteristics that I can point out.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's not just by the leaf, you know, I'm like, okay, well, it's got at least these 3 different things. So if I can't come up with 3 reasons why it's that plant, I probably don't know it well enough to eat it.
Hmm.
And it's also really good to know, does this plant have any poisonous lookalikes?
Oh.
Yeah.
Yep.
So if you don't have 3 good reasons why it's that plant, and if you can't answer if it has any poisonous lookalikes, probably shouldn't be eating it.
Right. So it sounds like you were talking about, it sounds like you have to follow the plants through a season, which means that you're looking at about a year-long learning curve, which is probably the part people don't like because they get excited. And then I think as well, sustaining your interest through that learning period, it's probably the hardest part.
That's how having like some mentors
yeah.
or a community of
really
people
helps. Yeah.
really helps because you know, I'm quite happy, you know, if I take someone out on a walk on their property, you know, and I'm, or they come to my property or whatever, and I'm able to say, point out plants and that they can see and that they then can then go home right
mm-hmm.
away and they know it's, you know, sometimes
yeah.
they'll even send me a photo. Is this the same one we looked at? And I'll be like, yeah.
Yes.
Then they can start, but it's also, there's so many plants that we're actually already familiar with.
Yeah.
that's, you know.
That's the beauty of it.
That's the beauty of it,
mm-hmm.
is that, sure, like, maybe there's certain plants that you don't, you know, maybe if you want to start working with yarrow, maybe you'd have to learn yarrow and figure out how to make sure you knew yarrow from a poisonous lookalike. But there are plants, like, we're just talking about, like, dandelion or really common things that people probably already could give them, you know, already have the identification part down, just because they're common plants. And so then they can start working with it sooner while they're developing that deeper relationship of learning some of the other plants.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's true. So right place, right plant.
Yeah, right. So right season. So mm-hmm. every right season and right part. Those are kind of the two things.
Mm-hmm.
So, so if I'm harvesting roots, for example, I always think, so right season, I always think I want to harvest the part of the plant when the real life force of that plant is in there. So general rule, so roots, so below ground parts, generally if we're in a temperate region, we're looking at spring and fall, basically when the plant's gone dormant and all of its life force is in the roots.
Mm-hmm.
You're also going to find that they're actually just bigger, like they're actually larger, they're juicier, they taste better.
Oh,
if you
right.
go and harvest dandelion roots in the middle of the summertime, you're going to find them very woody.
Okay.
And actually way more bitter. And not good tasting.
Yeah.
Whereas if I harvest dandelion roots in the fall, they're actually, you know, bigger, they're fatter, they have more water in them. They also have more inulin, which is actually a little sweeter that balances some of the bitter that's in them. So they're actually a lot more palatable. So it's not just a, like, new age life force thing. It actually is.
Yeah.
There actually is a reason, so.
Yeah.
Roots, you know, spring and fall, and then young greens, and I think of, like, right now, you know, we were just saying last night, right now is the salad bowl. The forest is a salad bowl.
Mm.
And it always seems to time out because early spring, right now I'm harvesting beech leaves and basswood leaves and dandelion leaves and all of these greens, which... You know, my garden is still too small. My lettuces are an inch tall. So
yep.
my salad bowl is the forest. Whereas by July, all of those greens are going to, you can almost picture if you're, you know, a temperate region, you can see the leaves are bright, vibrant, almost lime green when they're first coming out. And then they turn to that darker green a few weeks later. Once they become that darker green, they're going to become a little tougher and bitter. So we want to get them when they're really young. Flowers and berries is really just when they're, just in full bloom.
Mm-hmm.
I even like to get flowers, if I think of it, right before they're, like, basically we want to catch them before they've been pollinated by the insects.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so I even catch them, like, just as they're starting to open. And berries will often let you know. So berries, they change color.
Yeah.
And you, berries are like that. We all know probably the experiences from children, like, we all learn what the good tasting strawberries and raspberries are because they're sour before, you know, and then they turn that nice sweet and they go soft and red.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so that's the right season and then right part, kind of covered that a little bit there, but just know that if you hear about that a plant is edible, don't assume it's the whole plant.
Right.
So always give this example, so we take something for granted like a tomato.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, tomatoes are edible, but we all know it's the fruit.
Yeah.
Leaves of tomato are totally toxic.
Hmm.
If you ate a tomato plant, you'd probably die.
Wow.
But we all just take for granted that we know that. So if you hear that, I'm trying to think, burdock is edible, you're like, oh, great, burdock's edible. But the leaves and the stems are actually quite awful, but the root is what's edible. So understand any, you have to just make sure you know which parts of that plant are edible.
Yeah, that's a pretty important distinction.
Yeah, and that's what I mean. Like, we just kind of, oh, that plant's edible, but like I said with the tomato, here's a classic example of we just take for granted that we know it's the fruit.
Right.
So always make sure you're really clear what parts of the plant are edible, because definitely not all edible plants are going to have all edible parts. And then the last, which kind of also feeds into that, so that's the right part. The last one is the right preparation.
Mm-hmm.
And so for some medicinal plants or edible plants in particular, there's edible parts, but they require some pre-preparation. Potatoes are kind of a funny one that way. Again, relating it back to something we take for granted. We cook potatoes. If you ate a bunch of raw potatoes, your stomach's probably going to feel pretty off. So a good wild plant example is milkweed. So milkweed is one of my favorite edible plants. It's like one of my favorite, you know, real vegetables. I can actually harvest a lot of it. I can pickle it, you know. But it's got this milky white latex, that's the milk in its name. You actually have to blanch those, you know, whether it's the pods or the young flower buds or the shoots, in at least three changes of water, or not at least, but three changes of water, to leach that latex out before you eat it. So it's an important preparation that's required. And even just something like fiddleheads, they need to be cooked.
Right.
You know, certain foods just, so you have to really understand, and it's good just to know, is this something I can eat raw, or is this something that has to be cooked? Elderberries, you know, I use elderberries all the time, but like, elderberries need to be cooked before, otherwise, now often what you'll find is if you don't, what it'll just make you do is throw up. So if people tell me they threw up from eating something, that's my first question back to them is, how did you prepare it? And if they say they ate it raw, or they just, you know, if it was milkweed, they just cooked it once, then often when I'm troubleshooting with them, because they, you know, they're like, oh, I read that jewelweed was edible, and I ate a bunch and I got sick, and then that's always my first question, how did you prepare it? And when they tell me how they prepared it, that's the piece that was missing, you know, there's a piece of information regarding preparation. And the unfortunate thing, there's a lot of information about wild plants, particularly on the internet you'll find a lot of things, but you want to make sure that you, for each of those plants, you can walk through those five rites, you know, I'll go through it on my hand, do I really know those, like, can I answer those five to myself before consuming that plant?
Yeah, that is really valuable information. It just goes to show that there's so much more to it than what you previously might have thought. Like, it's about so much more than knowing what a plant looks like and that you can eat it.
Yeah.
There's so much to consider. I was curious, though, about the milkweed pods, because you said it's your favorite, and because those are commonly available. So when are you harvesting those, and sort of what are you mentioned blanching them, so, but you know, aside from that, what are you doing with them? How are you eating them?
Yeah, so with the milkweed pods, so that's, you know, after it's flowered, and I think we all have more of a relationship, and people think, they're like, oh, aren't they fuzzy?
Because
our relationships are often, you know,
like
with
the fluff
once they
inside
open.
And yeah.
Yeah, so if you catch them when they're green, they're under about an inch and a half. So when they're about an inch long and they're tight green little pods, that's my favorite time to catch them. So inch and a half long, I'll go, and I won't pick them all. You know, if there's a bunch of plants, I'll often just pick, you know, one or two or three off of a plant, you know, that has... It's quite a few. Really, they produce so many seeds, and most of the time they're going to be spreading more by their roots, so I definitely would never take more than half of the pods off of the plant.
Okay.
So I go around and I collect all my pods, and then I do, you know, bring a pot of water to boil, throw them, I'll often do them in big batches if I'm going to spend the time blanching, you know?
Yeah.
So I'll do a big pick of them. Fill a basket, and then I bring a large pot of water to boil, put them in, let them boil for a minute, take them out, and then I empty that water out, bring another pot, and I do that three times. So that's the labor part.
Mm.
But then they're prepared. So at that point, once they've been leached three times, what I'll do is then I will take a bunch and freeze them, and then I will freeze them and put them in, you know, smaller kind of single meal portion size, and I will freeze those, and I'll use them as like a frozen vegetable. So I'll add them into pastas, I'll throw them in lasagnas, we've put them on pizzas, we do a number, I also pickle them, so I often do big batches, so I'll just, you know, a standard pickling brine, so it's like, you know, with apple cider vinegar and water and your pickling spice and some garlic, and I just do like a standard pickle of them, and like they're really interesting on a pickle tray. And, you know, there's times where I'll pull them out of the free, you know, like, that's why I like to, if I'm going to do the pick and do the blanching, I'll just get them all. So then I'll pull some out of the freezer and I'll, you know, throw them in the stir fry and, you know, or saute them up in butter with some asparagus, or there's just so many, they cut basically to me, they're kind of like a green bean.
Oh, okay.
So that is kind of their closest. That's the closest thing, and I fed them to a lot of people, and I would say the largest portion of people say that they taste like a green bean.
Oh, interesting.
So I just, you can get really creative. And that's what I like. Once I've done, you know, the work of blanching that big batch, now once I've frozen them into, you know, or pickled them or whatever, I've got, now they're super easy to use. Wild food, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So are they taste like a green bean, are they a similar texture?
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
Huh.
Like, as if it had been, like, a steamed bean, you know?
Yeah. No, yeah, yeah. Cooked, so, yeah. Like, yeah, of course. Wow, I gotta try this now. So, what time of year are they about an inch long?
Yeah,
I'm assuming, like, maybe June?
Yeah, actually, no, a little later.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so probably August.
Oh,
so
really?
Basically, because right now, the shoots are just starting to come up.
Okay.
And then June, July, they're gonna flower, and it's a little later summer. So kind of August is when the pods are ready, and then often by end of August, September is when the fluff starts, you know, they're starting to open up.
Okay.
Yeah. Huh. So it's a little later summer that you're picking them.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, I'm definitely going to keep an eye out for those.
Yeah.
Okay. So what is one, I mean, I had originally planned to talk about more examples, but we've covered so much ground with so much awesome information that, what is one plant that you're working with right now that is easy for listeners to go out and try without having to go, because it's easily recognizable and all of that, so without the year-long learning curve or whatever.
Yeah,
so,
of course.
Yeah, yeah. So what's one thing that you could sort of point us toward?
So one thing I'm working with a lot right now is just spruce. So spruce tips.
Okay.
So right now the young buds, so the spruce trees, we can picture them, they're like the classic Christmas tree. And it doesn't matter what species. This is what I love about it too.
Oh, nice.
It doesn't matter if it's a white spruce, a black spruce, maybe you're in the city and you've got a blue spruce growing in your yard. Doesn't matter which variety of spruce. We can use them all interchangeably. And so the very young tips of the spruce are opening up. And so when they're young and soft, if you go and nibble on them, they actually have a really delicious citrusy flavor.
Really?
Yeah, so that's the, it's the vitamin C. As I've been learning plants over and over again, I actually just think vitamin C is the flavor of citrus, because so many plants that are high in vitamin C all have that same flavor.
Right, okay.
So the flavor is like, I'm learning, oh, that's the flavor of vitamin C, it's that citrusy flavor.
Okay, yep.
It just seems that way.
Mm-hmm.
So I go and I pick those super young, the tips while they're young and soft, and so can infuse it in vinegar and make a really delicious vinegar. I make a strong tea of it and then strain it out and make a simple syrup that is delicious in cocktails or drizzled on desserts. I'll even grind them up, you know, just in a little coffee grinder, or I have like a food processor, and mix it half and half with either salt or sugar.
Oh, wow.
And then dry, like, let the salt will just drop, like the salt will actually, it's so interesting if you put like a white sea salt in with the spruce tips, and then as it, you know, and just, I'll go and just kind of mix it every day. What you'll find, the salt will actually change color. It will absorb flavor
seriously?
The spruce tips.
Huh.
And then the salt is, and then I just use that as a spice, you know, and things.
Yeah.
And it actually takes on the flavor. So it's really, it's an awesome salt, particularly like fish or like on eggs or, yeah, you can find lots of fun things to do with it. The sugar, I'll even let the sugar, like if I mix it together, the moistness from the spruce tips will make the sugar go wet.
Okay.
And then I'll just like, as soon as it goes wet, I'll either put it through the dehydrator and it'll like, or just stick it on a cookie tray in your oven on the lowest setting with the door cracked for like a few hours.
Okay.
And it'll turn to this like candied spruce tip, so I call it my spruce tip sugar, and it just basically creates this like spruce candy. And I'll sprinkle that on like desserts. Like I made a Japanese knotweed and rhubarb crisp the other day, and I sprinkled spruce tip sugar on it, you know.
Yeah.
It's just this like, or berry tarts, you know. It's
like
this really, and then, you know, it's just a really great spice. You know, I think of it as just like bringing that wild flavor into some like standard recipes, like apple crisp.
Yeah.
So,
oh, I love that.
So there's a lot of different things, you know, you can pickle the spruce tip, if you get them really nice and tight, you know, they'll even be like this papery sheath, just coming off of them.
Oh,
that's the
okay.
perfect time to catch them, you know, when that papery sheath is still there. If you catch them when they're really tight, you can still pickle them at that phase. I guess there's the Canadian martini, I guess, has pickled spruce tips in it.
Oh, okay.
And, you know, delicious with fish dishes. You know, I think of that even when I'm on canoe trips. Even if the spruce is little, you know, bigger and tougher if it's midsummer, mm-hmm. if I catch a fish when I'm on a backcountry canoe trip, you know, and I don't have lemon with me, I'll pick spruce tips and we, you know, we'll open the trout up and just stuff the belly of the fish with spruce tips before cooking it on the fire to be my little citrusy flavor enhancer in the backcountry.
Wow, all of that sounds amazing. And I always notice the spruce tips when I'm walking. I love them because they're that shade of green that's just so beautiful. So they're easy to spot, for
yeah.
sure.
Yeah.
So then it sounds like if you're making the sugar or the salt, the process is pretty simple. You just literally snip them off and go to it.
Yeah.
If you're making a simple syrup or... that was the other thing you mentioned, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So that, do you dry them at all, or you just go right ahead and boil them in water?
Yeah, so you don't even need to really boil them. You could kind of fill a jar. I would picture filling a jar halfway full with the spruce tips.
Okay.
And then just bring a kettle to boil and pour the water over the jar and fill the jar up to the top, you know, so you've almost kind of got twice as much water as the tips. And then let that sit at least overnight so you get a good long infusion. And then you strain the tea, essentially. You're just making a tea out of them. You strain the tea from the plants, give it a good squeeze so you get all the water out of those spruce tips.
Mm-hmm.
All those last few drops are going to be your most potent
right.
flavor.
Yep.
So get as much of the water as you can out of them. And then a simple syrup is just, you know, either 1-to-1 with sugar.
Okay.
Or, like, more of a long, like, that doesn't last too long. Like, a 1-to-1 will last maybe 2 weeks in the fridge.
Really?
So I often do a 2-to-1, so it's 2 parts sugar to 1 part syrup. But that lasts. It's very sweet.
So you only need a little.
You only need a little, but it lasts. Like, I've been doing some, like, shelf tests, and I still have a simple syrup in my fridge that I made from violets last year. And it's still totally fine.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so 2-to-1 sugar syrup is going to last for longer, but most often, if you're just doing small batch that you're going to use up quickly, just do a 1-to-1.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Whoa, okay, so definitely, I'm going to go out and try that too,
because
it sounds good. And I've had some spruce things before. I found it very strong, but maybe that was just in the preparation of it. Maybe they were more mature. I don't know, so I'm definitely, I'll check back in with you, but I'm so curious about trying this, and it sounds so easy, which is what I love, because you know, I mean, honestly, the thing about this is that it's an investment in time, and it's hard to find that time sometimes, but this is something you can literally do in minutes.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah, and like, you know, there's, you know, as opposed to some of the other plants where there's like, you know, again, the confusion around like, well, how do I know I have the right plant, or, you know, am I picking too much, and, you know, sustainability, like, I could go out and commercial harvest spruce tips and not even make a dent at all.
Right, so that's nice to know for sure.
So that's, I really love teaching people the conifers in the beginning.
Yeah.
And we bring conifers into our home every year at
Christmas.
We plant them in our yards and they're plants that I think we kind of take for granted our relationship with them.
Mm-hmm.
We build our homes with them, and
mm-hmm.
so the more ways I can introduce people to be in relationship with conifers, the better.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, that's fantastic. So, wow. I mean, like, literally, I'm gonna have to go back and listen to this like 5 times just to get. I mean, sitting here talking with you, I feel like there's just so much information that you shared. So thank you for that. I really appreciate you and the knowledge that you have. I mean, it's truly incredible. It's admirable. So just in closing, it might be hard to come up with right now, but are there any resources that come to mind that you could easily point people to if they want to know more?
Sure. Well, one book, it's actually produced in Canada. Sometimes it's a little tricky to get a hold of, but it's called The Boreal Herbal.
Okay.
And the author's name is Beverly Gray. It is a really great book. So she's actually from the Yukon. So a lot of the plants are northern plants, but the whole book is actually really beautifully balanced between her use of wild foods and medicine. And she's got really the you know, beginning and the end of the book, you know, where she's talking about harvesting and tools and sustainability and just how to make use of plants, is a really good guide. And I think for people just starting out, that regardless of whether or not you have cloudberry, you know, which is a plant from the tundra, doesn't matter. It's the other parts of the book are really, really useful. And then a lot of the plants do still grow here.
Yeah.
So that's a really good book. A really good resource guide for just starting to look at wildflowers. You know, those are often pretty inspirational plants and cover a lot of medicinal plants. Newcomb's Wildflower Guide is a really good book. That's one of kind of the main books that I'll get people to start looking at in terms of a wildflower book to start. And it really helps you. It's got a really cool key system. So keys are what we use in field guides to not try to match up a photo. Like, we don't just flip through until I find a photograph. Keys help you to actually learn the parts of the plants.
Okay.
So that you're able to clearly say those three different ID features. So the Newcomb's Wildflower Guide has a really good key system to help you kind of repattern your brain of how to look at plants.
Awesome.
And then, any field guides that are local to your place.
Right.
You know?
Yep.
So
Forest
plants of Central Ontario, where we are, whether it's edible medicinal plants of Southern California or,
So you're relying mostly on books as opposed to the internet, it sounds like?
Yeah, so it's, the internet is, there's a lot of information out there, and there's a lot of bad information. There's really good stuff and really bad stuff.
For sure. Comes down to trusting the source.
Yep. Mm-hmm. So that's, that is a little trickier, for sure. If you're interested in wild foods, any of the work, Arthur Haynes, Delta Institute, he's from Maine. He's a really good resource of really good, high-quality wild foods information. He's got lots of YouTube videos, and so he's a botanist, so he's got a really good, you know, he writes botanical guides for the state of Maine. So he's someone that really knows his plants, and he's got years of working with the plants from experience. It's the biggest thing I'll look at if you're looking at different resources on the internet. Really just have a critical eye. Is the author writing it from personal experience? So if you're writing, you know, it could be a really good blog from an unknown person, but just really look carefully. Are they writing about this from their own years of personal experience? So that's the biggest thing I look at. If it's from their personal experience, and they're able to show that this is a plant that they've been working with for a few years, you know, they've eaten it through the seasons or at different times. You know, if you're wondering about RC, like, ask them, have you been doing this for a while? That's the kind of critical eye that I'll have, is that as long as they're not just, you know, I read this in a book or I've heard, you know, as long as the statements that people are making about plants are from my experience, or here's my recipe that I do every spring. Those are the kind of things that, as long as it's from, speaking from a place of experience, as opposed to regurgitating information that they read from somewhere else. We all know the danger of that broken telephone.
Absolutely.
Yeah, so those are my key things.
Okay.
I mean, people all over the world have been using
plants. Yeah.
And there's 101 ways to use them. So I feel like as long as people have that experience, and then just be careful for, you know, understand for yourself, particularly for someone, you know that what might be safe for other people might not be safe for you, particularly if you're someone that you know you're kind of prone to allergies and stuff.
Oh, right.
Just
tiny amounts, start super small and slow.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, my goodness. Well, thank you so much again. So just before I go, where can people go to find out more about you?
Okay, yeah, so my business is called Wild Muskoka Botanicals. So you can search wildmuskokabotanicals.ca and find my website. You can sign up for my newsletter. You can find me on Facebook and I now have an Instagram account.
Oh, you do? Great.
Okay. I don't have a smartphone, but I'll manage it somehow.
Oh, geez.
I'll figure it out.
Yeah. I kind of feel like that would be really valuable to start documenting that with I know technology. It's kind of like you resist it, but it kind of has its moments.
While crafting is often takes me into very beautiful places, mm-hmm. and there's so many times I actually do feel like, God, this is so beautiful. I really should be sharing.
It's a shame that you're that I'm not. I can see that. Yeah.
So my Instagram account's supposed to make me take more photos while I'm in the forest and doing beautiful things and spending time with beautiful plants, because it's one thing I've learned, and probably the thing that I love most about wildcrafting and working with plants is they're just so beautiful and such beautiful little beings that they, just working with them makes me feel better.
Yeah, absolutely. It's such an inspiring, beautiful way to live and lead your life, so I admire you for that. So thank you once again. I truly appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
So that concludes my talk with Laura. Hopefully you never look at dandelions, spruce tips, or milkweed the same ever again. I know there was a lot packed into that episode, so be sure to head over to puregreenmag.com/podcast/Laura Gilmore for show notes and links to the resources we talked about. Share your thoughts with us over on Facebook at facebook.com/puregreenmag, and please leave a review for us over on iTunes if you enjoyed this interview with Laura. Thank you for listening to this week's show. I'm Celine McKay, and you're listening to the Pure Green Podcast.